Welcome back to another midsummer episode of the Rhode Island Educator's Guide to Personalized Learning. I'm your host, Arthur Barriff. In late May, one of the great student-centered educators passed away. His name was Michael Armstrong, author of the classic book Closely Observed Children, A Diary of a Primary Classroom, which charted the year of a primary school class as children worked on writing, art, mathematics, and sciences. Michael was also a mentor of mine when I studied with him for one amazing summer at Middlebury's Breadloaf School of English back in 2009. He taught a legendary class called Describing the Imagination, during which we engaged in close observations of the work of children to understand creativity and student-centered pedagogy. That same summer, I took a nonfiction writing class. The final assignment for that class was to write a profile. I chose Michael Armstrong as my subject and spent many hours interviewing him about his life. With all that material, I produced an essay in which I tried to describe the broad strokes of his intellectual journey. The best I could, at least. When I learned of his death a few months ago, I was deeply saddened about the loss of this great mind to our world. So now I'd like to share with you what I wrote about his life, to honor and to remember him. Part of becoming student-centered educators is to learn the history and intellectual foundation of our work. So thanks for listening. And forgive me for mispronouncing the names of some British towns. I really did my best. And now, to my essay about the life of the great educator, Michael Armstrong. An imagined man. After leaving Italy, after the bombings, after the war, young Michael Armstrong's father left England and returned to Rome. It was 1945, and Charles Wesley, the leader of the Methodist Church of Italy, said goodbye to his twin sons, Michael and David, his eldest, Alan, and his wife, Elsie. It was not yet safe for the family to return to their apartment, which overlooked the Tiber and the Ponte San Angelo. And after all, Michael and David were an English boarding school, and their studies were very, very important. Yes, he had to go back alone. As his father did the mysterious work of the church in Italy, Michael, in his head of curly blonde hair, pursued his own mysteries, dreaming of Pericles in Athens, Hector in Troy, Odysseus, the Trojan War, Tiberius, and his ultimate hero, Pheidippides, the marathoner. Months of hiding from the sounds of bombers and metal cages had passed, yet Michael continued to imagine himself in another place, member of an ancient civilization, speaker of ancient codes, merchant of ancient cultures. He walked imaginary cobblestone corridors in a simple belted tunic, making conversation with passing members of the Roman Legion. Fed by books from his mother, Michael let his obsession flourish. His passion intensified at 13, on a summer stay in Rome with his father. For a school project, Michael wandered the Forum Romanum. He photographed the crumbled arches and wrote flamboyant prose. He returned home to England in the fall, ready to impress. Several months later, on a return trip to England via Portugal, Father Charles contracted the flu. Elsie joined him at a London hospital to aid his recovery while the boys vacationed in the country with their grandparents. Near Christmas, at the cottage, the phone rang. Costumed for an impromptu family play, Michael learned that his father was dead. As he matured, Michael distinguished himself through his knowledge and rigorous study of the classics. He read Latin well and fulfilled his father's hope by reading the Gospels in Greek. By 16, Michael was one of two students in his school who exclusively studied ancient civilizations. At 18, he chose to continue his studies as an undergraduate at Oxford. At the oldest university in the English-speaking world, Michael immersed himself in deeper language study, Greek and Roman history, Aristotle, Plato, and eventually analytic philosophy, epistemology, metaphysics, morality, ethics, Wittgenstein, and ordinary language philosophy. Although his love for the classics did not diminish, Michael's intellect was captured by the big ideas, the rigor of clear thought, and the deep meditation on text, language, and life. If I had tried harder, he later reflected, I could have been a scholar of ancient civilization. But at 22, Michael made a home at the library, put his full energies into philosophy, and continued at Oxford toward an advanced graduate degree. Yet the world of pure ideas did not contain him. It felt limiting, he said 53 years later. It was the world of action, politics, policy, and breathing society that seduced him. modern civilization playing more complex and adult iterations of the stories that captured his imagination as a child. Morals and ethics on the world stage. Britain was fighting for the ocean link to her colonies in India and the Far East. Hungary was struggling for freedom from Russia. Morocco and Tunisia gained independence from France. Composing coffee shop manifestos with classmates at Oxford, Michael founded the New Left Review to grapple with these issues. It wasn't long before he found his own cause. In addition to Suez and oil rationing, England was debating major reform of her schools. The tripartite system, which sorted students at a young age into one of three tracks, was being called into question. One of those asking the questions was a 23-year-old, confident-voiced Michael Armstrong. After attending an education conference at the London Festival Hall, at which he was introduced to education reform philosophy, Michael published the first of his articles that laid out moral and practical arguments for the institution of a comprehensive school system. Yet life as a movement spokesman was not sufficient for him. Michael understood that he also belonged in schools, that he would need to fight from within the ranks. After missing the deadline for the University of London's education school, which his wife remarked 53 years later was very typical of him, Michael enrolled at the University of Leicester, a fortunate accident because it was there he met Isabel, his wife. There, Michael acquainted himself with progressive education, Dewey, whose ideas he disliked at first, and teaching methods that dealt with post-streaming challenges. After earning his degree and license, Michael taught English for 4 years at Wadsworth Boys' School in London, a former grammar school that was now comprehensive. He almost gave up after the first year. His gentle, open style was slightly mismatched with the rowdy boys of his classes. But upon the advice of his mentor teacher, Michael stayed on and learned the craft of managing a class. He also continued to think and write, and his talents in these areas begot him opportunities to research comprehensive school reform at the Institute of Community Studies and with the Nuffield Foundation's Resources for Learning project. He became a passionate believer in comprehensive schools and the egalitarian society it promised. Yet 6 years into the world of education research and policy had gone by, and Michael was only beginning to understand schools and the life lived within them. Ready to return to the classroom, he took a position as head of social studies at Cowsthorpe, a well-known progressive secondary school in Leicester. The faculty was committed to the intellectual work of teachers and students, and traditional methods and structures were questioned and dismantled. The school, run democratically by teachers and students, was a statement. The parents didn't understand it, but the faculty was sure that the experiment was noble and that their progressive ideas deserved this laboratory. Michael spent afternoons arguing passionately with his colleagues about matters such as the importance of meta-awareness in the learning process. Subject lines were erased. Social studies became humanities, and Michael was teaching history, English, the arts, and even math. The students gathered with six teachers in a library and moved around from group to group, pursuing their interests, playing with ideas, and making sense of it all. It was all very exciting. 38 years of perspective later, though, Michael described the period as rather quaint, a romantic endeavor, and a product of a particular zeitgeist. It was sometime during these years that Michael lost interest in the school. The governance, politics, and operations of it no longer concerned him. Now, with the same group of students for almost two-thirds of their school life, working intensively in a relatively open learning environment, Michael directly confronted the most basic questions that presented themselves to teachers. How do children learn? How do they think? What is at the heart of their imaginative practice? These questions had always been at the core of every student-teacher interplay, but had rarely been contemplated or explored by its practitioners. Michael had found his way to a new obsession, the inner workings of a child's mind. It was an ancient world, yet alive in the present, and needing someone to explore it, map it, and tell its stories. The task required the rigor and wisdom of a philosopher-teacher, and Michael felt well suited to it. Somewhere along this intellectual journey, Michael discovered an often overlooked series of essays by Leo Tolstoy on education. In one essay, Tolstoy, one of the world's greatest novelists, earnestly asked, Should peasant children learn to write from us, or should we learn to write from them? The answer, Tolstoy argued, is the latter. When he read this essay, Michael was profoundly influenced. As an older man, he claimed that it was the seed to all his future thinking. His years teaching at Cowdesthorpe consistently strengthened his belief that, quoting, "From their earliest acquaintance with the various traditions of human thought, children struggle to make use of these several traditions, of the constraints they impose, as well as the opportunities they present to examine, extend, and express in a fitting form their own experience and understanding." He published these words, though, 5 years later, after leaving Cowdesthorpe, to pursue in earnest his desire to observe children closely. Michael was moving into his fourth decade, and a 10-day conference in Loughborough shifted the course of his life. American educators had come there to share their innovations, leading Michael and other participants in disorienting workshops. He spent days there exploring rooms lavishly equipped with art materials, mathematic manipulatives, books of poetry. He became focused on building a huge camera obscura, while other teachers played with poetry, sculpted, painted, and built Archimedes screws. Meanwhile, the facilitators of the workshops maintained a background presence and answered questions. After lengthy exploratory time, the facilitators perhaps shared a key insight or asked a driving question to trigger more active learning. The workshops culminated with discussions about how these environments and opportunities could be of use to younger students, the implications and the challenges. Michael met the man he calls his guru at this conference, philosopher David Hawkins. He also gave his first talk on the Tolstoy essay that had been so germane to him. In the days that followed his lecture, conversations with Hawkins over cups of black tea pushed his thinking into even deeper territories. This confluence of people and ideas at Loughborough launched Michael into the next stage of his intellectual journey. But Italy, of course, was always there. It played in his imagination. It waited for him until summer. It was a country bound to his family history and to the mystery of his father. A place to scratch the itch that started in childhood. In 1972, while on the verge of this intellectual breakthrough, Michael, Isabel, and their children rented a cottage in southern Tuscany and spent 8 weeks gazing at frescoes, strolling the green terraced hills, and descending the steep, narrow cobblestone streets to the piazzas. Michael carried with him a notebook in which he scribbled his ideas. Trying out some of the direct, accessible style taught to him by Michael Young during his years researching at the Institute, Michael began to describe his impressions of the paintings in great detail. He suddenly found that he was writing more freely than he had ever done so before, no longer constrained by the strictures of his ingrained philosophical writing style. He wrote and wrote, and continued this practice when he returned to school in the fall. Michael knew that his next step was to write about the children he was so intrigued by. But how would he find the time at Cowdesthorpe, with all his teaching duties? In 1976, after deciding to leave Cowdesthorpe, Michael went to Sherard, a rural primary school directed by a Loughborough fellow, Mary Brown. There, Michael devised a plan to observe a year in the life of a primary classroom. He worked with Stephen Rowland and his class of 8 and 9-year-olds, observing, collaborating, reflecting, and writing. 2 years later, the book, Closely Observed Children, was complete. It was published in 1981. In this book, Michael explored the learning processes of individual students. Any doubts they may have lingered within him about Tolstoy's bold claims were put to rest. Children, Michael concluded, evinced high intent in all of their creative endeavors. They purposefully engaged, to varying degrees of seriousness and playfulness, with the world, as artists of any age do. They reconstructed reality and interpreted it within the confines of the discipline and their technique. But it wasn't just the conclusions that interested Michael. It was even more the process that led him to them. Michael did not concentrate on developing theories about how the children learn, as most scholars and philosophers tend to do. He concentrated instead on the children themselves. He described them with an anthropologist's scrutiny. He practiced Goethe's maxim, "There is a delicate form of the empirical which identifies itself so intimately with its object that it thereby becomes theory." Michael brought to bear his many years of experience in literature, language, history, art, philosophy, politics, education, schools, and classrooms on these empirical observations. The richness of his lens, the weight of his learning, allowed his observations themselves to discern theory from the particulars. Following the research and writing of Michael's book, Mary Brown offered him a position as kindergarten teacher at Sherrard. Although he was completely unqualified, Michael took the post for a year, and 30 years later he regards it as the best teaching job he has ever had. His journey then took him to Harwell School, where he was the beloved headmaster and principal teacher for 20 years. He published another book in 1999, in which he described children writing stories. He developed that book over a series of years while teaching graduate students at the Breadloaf School of English, Frost's school in Vermont's Green Mountains. In addition to Italy, Breadloaf was a reprieve from the day-to-day of teaching and running a primary school. Through the courses Michael taught, he developed his ideas about learning, and he returned to the Harwell year after year to gather materials from the children before coming back to Breadloaf to write. At 75, when I interviewed him, Michael was still honing his ability to discern theory from the specificity of children's creative work. His delicate white hand, slightly trembling, adjusted his eyeglasses and then returned to his lap, politely beside his linen shirt, the color of river sand. "I'm interested," he said, both with an Englishman's propriety and a child's mischievousness. In the little squiggle the young man added to the top right corner of the page. He is pointing to a seemingly unconscious doodle, a swirl of graphite, perhaps a spiral, perhaps a spring, that no one else likely noticed. "I see the imagination there. There's something about it there, pondering in the corner." His eyes and smile are impish and bright, like he's about to let you in on a clever joke. He is so close to the child's mind, he embodies it. Thank you for listening to my essay on the intellectual journey of one of the most significant impacts on my professional life, the late and great Michael Armstrong. Those of us who knew him through Breadloaf, his books, his schools, and his many projects will miss his gifts of curiosity, intellect, and creativity. Thanks for listening to the Rhode Island Educator's Guide to Personalized Learning, and have a great rest of your summer. And thanks to Alejandro Da Silva for our theme music, and please subscribe to this podcast on iTunes so that you can get the latest episode as soon as it's posted, and please tell others about it. We'll be back soon with more episodes of the Rhode Island Educator's Guide to Personalized Learning, and remember, learning is always personal.